Dialectical Behavior Therapy was created in the 1980s by Marsha Linehan in Seattle, Washington.
Today, DBT is taught all over the world.
We're two therapists who believe everyone can benefit from DBT skills.
I'm Kate.
I'm Michelle.
And this is DBT and Me.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
So, we have a listener-suggested topic today. I just feel so thankful for this listener suggesting this topic because it meant very little work for Kate and I to prepare for today's episode. So basically, the backstory here is that we got an email sent to us from a listener because in our last monthly episode when we were talking about how we had been using DBT skills ourselves recently and sharing personally, one of the things that I briefly mentioned when I was talking was about how I had been using radical acceptance in my relationship with my husband and recognizing ways that, like, oh, there's some codependency, like showing up in how I was acting and thinking about things in my relationship. And this listener wrote in and they were like, I would be curious to know more about that. Maybe you guys could do a monthly episode. And they gifted us with a list of questions as things that we could go over. And I was like, done. We'll take it. So basically today, we're just going to be going one by one through each of the questions that this listener asked. And we're going to each be giving a response to the questions as we go. But I'm really excited to talk about this topic of codependency. Before we dive in with promotion stuff, we have three new patrons from this last month. Yeah, amazing. So we are shouting out Michael, Susan, and Mallory.
Thank you
all for becoming patrons. If you want to become a patron, we have the link down in the show notes and you can go there and support the podcast. And we also have links to our Etsy shop down in the show notes. And our podcast, our other podcast, The Couch of the Chairs, you could check that out too. I realized with the topic today, I was like, some of this stuff we've already talked about on The Couch of the Chairs. So we may wind up referencing some of the episodes from that podcast that you might want to take a look at. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you could give us a rating or a review. I also just very recently learned that people could review on Spotify, or I guess maybe not write reviews, but they could give ratings. So feel free to do that as well if you're listening on Spotify. And as always, if you have questions for us, topic ideas for us, like this listener, dbtmepodcast@gmail.com is where you can reach out and find us. Okay, so diving in, I thought it would be a helpful place to begin with finding, I'm sure there could have been many definitions. I just snagged the first one that Google gave me, which is, I think, technically from Oxford Dictionary, it said, of what is a definition of codependency. And Kate and I, as we go through the episode today, I mean, we'll be sharing how we conceptualize codependency and how this shows up and what this looks like. But just as a starting point, before we dive into answering the questions, if you're already sitting here listening going, I don't actually really know what the word codependency means. What are you guys talking about? The way that it is defined, I'm going to just read it verbatim. It says, excessive emotional or psychological reliance on a partner, typically one who requires support on account of an illness or addiction. So the way that this definition of codependency is talked about is in the context of a romantic relationship, right? When it's talking about a partner, and also really thinking specifically about how the role of an illness, I interpret that as either like a physical illness or a mental health kind of illness or addiction, how that then leads to codependency developing is how they're talking about it here. But we're going to be diving into this a lot more in the first two questions that we're answering about what does this look like? And we're going to be taking, I think, that definition that I just read aloud for all of you and expanding on it a little bit more. and going into this. So to start, the very first question that was asked of us is, what does classic codependence look like? So you're going to kick us off with giving your answer to this, Kate, first.
Well, it's interesting because when I was going to put in my notes, my first thought really on this topic as a whole, actually, Michelle, when you told me that we had a listener write in about it was, oh, Michelle knows a lot more about this than I do. So that may become apparent today, because honestly, I mean, one of the things that came to mind when I was thinking about this is how this, like, codependency has always felt like something that I was supposed to know what it meant, but I never felt like I really got great education on it, like in school for therapy, actually. I just don't remember a huge amount of it getting talked about or defined or us getting taught really well how to help clients through it. Like, it's like it became such a well-known term that it stopped having a meaning that people thought was teachable. I don't know. It was weird. And so it's always been the sort of thing where people talk about it, and I'm like, ooh, I'm supposed to know what that means. And I kind of do, but I don't like kind of. That doesn't feel like a great way to know something. So, yeah, my idea of it, honestly, for a long time, and I'm starting to have a broader and better understanding of it, but for a long time, what I thought it looked like was generally partners or family members. My idea did even originally expand beyond necessarily just partners, but partners or family members of someone with an addiction. I really had only heard about it or thought about it initially in the context of addiction specifically. But yeah, someone, a partner or a family member of someone with addiction that, like, enables that addiction in order to stay, like, in the good graces of the addict, right? Like, someone making sure that they don't rock the boat. They don't ruffle feathers. They don't get... they don't rile things up in a negative way that would have consequences that maybe they don't feel ready and able to deal with. So, yeah, I think that was my concept of what quote-unquote classic codependence looked like. What about you, Michelle? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my initial awareness, or I guess being taught, what is codependency? What does it look like? Not too dissimilar from what you're describing there. I definitely was very much given the idea that you could only be codependent if you were in a relationship with somebody who was an addict. Like, even more specifically, an alcoholic, like, was kind of the vision that I had in my head. I read the book Codependent No More, and I've thought to myself for years, I'm like, Michelle, you actually need to reread this now when you could truly understand what it's talking about. I think I read Codependent No More. This, again, kind of speaks to the early seeds of Michelle will one day be a therapist being planted. My dad was given some self-help, you know, psychology-related books from a friend, and, like, in high school, I read Codependent No More. I don't remember any of it. I have a terrible, terrible, terrible memory for books and movies. I'll only remember, like, oh, I liked that, or oh, I did it. But I could tell you at this point, like, well, what did I take away from Codependent No More? But the book was so clearly directed, it felt like, at women, and really speaking to the fact of, like, this is what you do when you're, like, in a relationship with somebody who's an addict. So I just got this vision in my head of, if you were to ask me to define, like, what does somebody who's codependent look like? I'm like, well, it's a woman who's in a heterosexual relationship with a man who's an addict. That's what codependency looks like. And I really kind of just thought that, you know, it could look like somebody who's codependent, you know, I think about watching shows like Intervention and stuff like that. And they talk so much about the family enabling. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, somebody who's codependent, they would do all these enabling things. But also at the same time, they're like trying to get them to stop the addictive behavior, whatever it is. Like, okay, so maybe they're like hiding the alcohol because they don't want them to find it. but they're also like maybe giving them money to drink or like something like that. I have this idea in my mind that somebody who's struggling with codependency is both, yeah, like so scared of putting their foot down and saying this isn't okay, but in the background, they're doing these things kind of, you know, covertly because they don't like what their partner is doing. And I really just imagine somebody who's codependent being like somebody who just like doesn't have a voice, like very meek, very timid, tiptoeing, walking on eggshells around whoever, again, like their addict partner would be. And I definitely thought for a long time that codependency could only happen in the context of romantic relationships. So, yeah, I really got this idea of, oh, codependency looks this certain very narrow way.
Codependency looks straight. Sorry.
No, like truly. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. It looks like, yeah, this timid woman, this asshole man.
Yep.
That's what it looks like. That's what I thought for many, many years.
Well, that leads beautifully into the next question, Michelle, which is, how can codependence show up in subtler ways?
Yeah, so if we want to take what codependency is and really, really dive into it, truly, I think. Now I feel like when people talk about codependency, what it really seems like we've come to learn and see is that codependency can actually be like pretty synonymous with people-pleasing behaviors. So when we say that like somebody is being codependent, that's kind of what we're getting at. It's like, oh, they're really wanting to keep the peace and they don't want to rock the boat. And that's what's going on here. And in my mind, that can happen in the context of any relationships. That does not just apply to romantic relationships. And, I mean, I think certainly we know now compared to, I don't even know when Melody Beatty wrote Codependent No More. I think it was like the 80s, but I mean, gosh, we certainly know that now codependency is not just a female problem, you could say. Anybody in any kind of relationship can fall into that place where they're really prioritizing and focusing more on the other person's needs and wanting to do things kind of at all costs, like, yeah, keep them happy and to keep things harmonious. And I really see it showing up, codependency, as like oftentimes it looks like trying to rescue people when you're concerned about them, not for any reason. I mean, not just addiction, like how we thought about codependency for a long time in the early days. But any time that you may find yourself in this place of there's somebody in your life that you're really concerned about and you're wanting to just dive in and try to like prevent them from doing the thing that you're scared of them doing, or really getting into this place of thinking that you probably know what's best and like kind of overstepping your boundaries out of, you know, right, we could paint it as this picture of like, well, it's just because I love and I care about them. But it's also not respecting that people have the ability to figure out their own lives. So somebody who struggles with codependency, it can look like that a lot, of really trying to manage and control and rescue other people that they're worried about for whatever reason. And I kind of feel like there's certainly, I think, more reasons than this, but I really try to narrow it down to like, where does codependency come from? Like, what makes somebody go through life in a way where in their relationships they're behaving codependently? What causes this? And one reason is that if you, from a very young age, were taught early on that you can't really rely on people, specifically like your parents, right? If you're a child and your parents are just constantly like not meeting your needs, letting you down, you learn pretty quickly that you need to step up to the plate to try to manage things yourself. So you can get very good at taking care of things for other people, right? If it's a situation where you're like, well, I know my mom or my dad probably isn't gonna like make me something for dinner tonight. Guess what? I need to figure out my own food. So it can look like that. It can very much look like if especially you have like younger siblings in your life or other people around you and the adults in your life are not taking care of your needs or their needs, you get really good at putting your own needs on the back burner and taking care of other people's needs too, right? So this can look like tending to a parent. If you have a parent who's not taking good care of themselves, yep, as I was just speaking to, tending to younger siblings. But you just basically feel as you're going through your childhood like you are alone. And if something is going to get done, you got to do it yourself because you can't count on people around you. And so then that can translate into adulthood to where you're just like really good at anticipating other people's needs. You might not need to anticipate other people's needs anymore, but you got good at it when you were young. And so you're kind of always the person who's like making sure that everybody's taken care of and everybody else is okay. And where are you in that equation? You're probably not paying much attention to the toll that that's taking on you or what you need, right? So that's one reason I think that this can start. The other reason is that you just may have been taught that this is what you should do and praised for behavior like that. So what I mean is like, well, I'll just give an example from my own life because this is where it comes from for me is the second reason. I very much had adults who I could count on in my life and that kind of a thing. But I was given messages like from my mom, who I'll probably wind up referencing at various points throughout this episode with how codependency shows up for her. She has no clue how codependent she is. But let me tell you guys, she very much is that I was basically told like by my mom, like say I was, you know, matched up with a group in school for a school project. And, you know, I'm like, well, I've done my part, but so-and-so hasn't done their part yet for the project. And my mom would be like, well, then you need to do it in order to get a good grade. And so I would do it. Kate's face is like aghast. Yep. But I was basically always told, like, you don't want the ball to ever get dropped. So if somebody else is going to drop the ball, you need to pick it up. And you need to make sure that, like, it doesn't even get dropped in the first place. So you're, like, praised and taught. And I'm sure, I mean, I know my teachers were like this in school. Gosh, they were just like, Michelle is always, you know, she's so on top of things. And she's always, you know, someone that her classmates turn to. And she's such a leader. And all this stuff. And you're just, like, praised and built up that, like, this is what you should do. You're supposed to pick up the slack for other people. You're supposed, and it's right, it's like it's being helpful, quote unquote. I'm doing air quotes as I say that, right? And that you are just supposed to make sure that everybody around you is okay and that it's something that's positive. It's like a positive character trait to have, to be worried about and concerned for other people and to take care of them even when they're not asking you to. this is what you're supposed to do. So that's very much messaging that I was received. And I think it is for that second reason a lot, even though we've already named that, like, doesn't matter what your gender is, you can still struggle with codependency. I think it is something that can very much be seen more in people who were raised female. Because for centuries and through generations passed down, this is very much what I was talking about for that second reason, messaging that just like girls and women have been taught of like, this is what it means to be a good wife, a good mother, right? Like all these things. Your job, your role is to take care of other people. That is what you are supposed to do. Like that socialization runs so deep if you're female. So I think that's why, like, it's not uncommon that you may see traits of codependency show up more in women than in men. But yeah, it's kind of just because sometimes you're just told, like, this is how you're supposed to move through the world, is by taking care of everybody else and making sure that everything is okay at all times. That's just, that's a good thing that you do that. So you just do it your whole life until you enter therapy and your therapist is like, hold on a second, maybe you're doing too much. Wouldn't be speaking from personal experience there at all. But that's kind of how I see it when it comes to, like, codependency. I mean, it can encompass so many different things and crop up for different reasons.
Absolutely. I like your two reasons, and I want to be like, can it be and? Can it be both reasons? Because I think I'm
100%.
I think I'm a both reasons girl myself. Let's see. So I don't have a huge amount that's terribly different, just sort of other ways of thinking about it. Like, one of the things, the terms or ideas that occurs to me the most with the concept of codependency is the idea of overfunctioning. And especially that's, like, not trusting other people to do what needs to be done, either in general or for themselves. You know, you can be like, well, I don't trust them to do it because they have never done it, right? Like, be careful.
Yeah, good reason.
Yes, I was going to say, right? Like, because it's codependency is an easy thing to reason your way into, or think you are reasoning your way into. Like, it's just logical. He doesn't ever make his own dentist appointments. Of course I make them for him. I want his teeth in his face. Like, and he's never going to get there. So, right, like, this is the kind of thing that I think of often goes into overfunctioning. And also, Michelle, that fits so perfectly into the overfunctioning that so many times women are told to do. It's expected, it's correct that you do things like, oh, well, my husband just can't keep track of these things, so I pay the bills, or I make his dentist and doctor's appointments for him and remind him when they're coming up and tell him to take time off of work and right, I like, you do what needs to be done, but you don't leave space for the other person's agency or for them to have consequences to their own choices. It's all well and good that you want their teeth to stay in their face, but they're the ones that need to be motivated for their teeth to stay in their face, like, ultimately. Right? It's exhausting to try and be caring for yourself and someone else. By the way, if you're looking for some hints that it might be going on for you, I would say that abject exhaustion is not a bad starting place.
True.
In that you're like, I'm doing all of the things forever. Right? So that's one thing. I think about just overfunctioning, right? Like, just doing where the other person doesn't do. Whether that's they don't do because you've never given them the chance to do, or they don't do because they didn't do, so you started doing. Right? Like, either way, you're doing what other people really ought to be doing for themselves or for the relationship, right? Like, it can go both ways, right? Either about participating equally in the relationship and or taking care of themselves in that fashion. Definitely you can find, you know, you don't just have an on-off switch for you are or you are not a codependent person. It's absolutely something that can be more or less contextual, right? Maybe you're somebody who struggles in your romantic relationship, but you're cakewalk at work, right? Like, you've never even had a codependent inkling, I don't know, at your workplace. Lucky you. But, right, so it's not as simple as yes or no, right? There's not only is it contextual within different relationships or types of relationship, right? Spheres of life, you may have a hard time personally, but an easier time professionally, or vice versa. It's also like a spectrum or a range of severity, right? It can be something that you're like, yeah, if I look too closely at it, I probably have some tendencies that direction. All the way to, yes, every breath I've ever taken, right? Like, I don't know. Like, most things, there's a wide range of severity. So it's, you know, it can happen in fewer or more contexts and greater or lesser severity. So I think one of the things to look for is just to not have quite such black and white thinking about it, right? Not look for it as an on-off switch. It's either everywhere or nowhere, right? And to instead be ready for the exact subtleties that this question is asking for, right? About it being more of a dial, right? Instead of a light switch, right? On and off. And then I think the last thing I would have to say on this one is that codependence doesn't have to be a one-way street. I think even the way we've been talking about it up until this time is like there's the codependent person and then the person they are over-functioning for. Fun times! You can have two people both be codependent in the relationship with each other. Whee! right? Like, it can be just in different spheres, right? Or different types of behavior. You can have two people who are, say, for instance, two people struggling with addiction who are both enabling each other's addiction. Right? Like, there's all sorts of fun ways that codependence can show up. And one of them is in all directions, right? It doesn't just have to be unidirectional in a relationship context.
Mm-hmm. I really, really like this next question, which says, what's the distinction between codependency and a more natural need to exist in relationship with other people?
I like this one, too, because I get it, right? To an extent, if you're like, well, like, yeah, sometimes I do more for somebody else, right, than they're doing for me. Or, yeah, I compromise because I don't want to just piss someone off needlessly. Or, like, yeah, there are changes I make to my behavior to be in relationship with other people. Right? So where's the line? Exactly, like you said, Michelle. So the thing that first comes to my mind is a lack of balance. Right? Like, yes, in most relationships of pretty much any ilk, there's a balance of give and take. Right? It may not be perfect in any given moment. Right? Like, that's a weird thing to expect from humans. But overarchingly, there is a balance in that relationship, right? Obviously, different types of relationships, you're going to have different kinds of things you can expect, right? It's not, this is why it can look so much more, so different or so much more subtle in different kinds of relationships than it might look like in a partner relationship, right? A less intense relationship might show up with a less intense form of codependent behavior, right? But if you're looking at a relationship and you just go, wow, when I actually look at this, one person gives a whole lot more than they take. And the other person takes a whole lot more than they give, right? This is not a this week kind of problem, right? Like, this is looking at the relationship as a whole and seeing that it's, you know, that teeter-totter is tipped and doesn't move much. It appears, perchance, bolted in that position in the relationship. One of the ways that I was conceiving of this, because of the way the listener phrased the question of, you know, the need to exist in relationship with other people, is if existing in relationship with you isn't as important to a person as existing in relationship with them is important to you, then you're probably getting out of the realm of healthy interconnectedness and stepping towards something that is more likely to be codependent. There's other ways that things can be out of whack unhealthily that aren't codependence, but it's not a bad, you know, think. If you're like, all right, I just really need to mold myself to make existing with this person something that I can do, but they aren't molding back at all, right? Then that's a clue that distinction is existing there. So, yeah, those, I think, are my thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the first thing that came to mind for me with this question, and they, you know, they're talking about a more natural need to exist in relationship with other people. And the term for that that I learned from my therapist is to be interdependent. That's the goal. Because when we're interdependent in the relationships that we have in our lives, it means that there is kind of this, you know, you were talking about like give and take a little bit, Kate, mm-hmm. right? The give and take just feels a little more balanced, right? And we feel both comfortable, like relying on other people if we need to, asking people to help us. And also we feel okay on our own two feet as well if we need to, right? So we feel comfortable with both. We feel comfortable when it comes to the relationships that we have in our lives, and also recognizing that, okay, I'm still my own person within my relationships, and how can I be in tune with my own wants and needs as well as this other person's wants and needs. So there's that state that we hope for, which is being interdependent. Then there's codependency, like we've been talking about, and there's independence. So if you think of it like a spectrum there, independence is on one end, codependence is on the other, then in the middle, you have interdependence, which is what we want. With those three different states, you could say, they really correlate and line up with attachment styles. And I don't know, I feel like here and there on the podcast, maybe at some point, like in a Q&A somewhere or sometime, we've touched on attachment styles. I could talk about attachment all day long. And I won't go too into it here because I'll talk for way too long. If you want to learn more about attachment styles, though, if like what I'm about to talk about piques your interest, I highly encourage you to check out the book. It's called Attached. It's by Amir Levine and Rachel Heller. Check it out. Love it. It gives a very good overview into like what attachment is, helps you determine your attachment style and how to have your attachment style become secure. That's the goal. But basically, the premise behind attachment is that before the age of 3, we form an attachment, for better or worse, with our caregivers, right? Our parents or whichever adults are in our lives that we depend on to meet our needs when we are young children and cannot meet our needs ourselves. So we either learn that, hey, guess what? I can lean on those people. When I cry, they answer, they meet my needs consistently, I trust them. That happens, we form a secure attachment. And when we form secure attachments in childhood with the adults in our lives, we're more likely to then be interdependent in adulthood. So we either learn that I can lean on the adults around me and they're here for me, or we learn sometimes I can lean on them, sometimes I can't. And to be very, very clear, this is not like for anybody who is maybe a parent out there and like, oh my God, my child cried for longer than usual the other day before I could respond. Like, no, don't be too hard on yourself. But what we're talking about is like parents who sometimes want a lot of closeness with their children. And then sometimes parents who are quite rejecting of their children. So it's a very hot and cold relationship with the parent. And then that child develops an anxious attachment style, which really can then lead to a tendency towards codependency in adulthood, right? Which is the sense of, I never know how my parent is going to show up on any given day. I want to do whatever I can to make sure that they are here for me. How do I need to change myself so that they're going to like love me today and be here for me today? And that's often what somebody who struggles with codependency does, right? You can kind of like become this sort of chameleon and just try to like, you know, be flexible and adapt yourself to whoever is around you because you just want to, again, like make them happy and have that relationship feel good. And a child with an anxious attachment style learns this from a young age with their parent is like, I don't know how they're going to show up. So I'm just going to do whatever it takes for them to be okay. And somebody with an anxious attachment style, like really wants a lot of closeness and becomes very overwhelmed when they don't get kind of like reliable communication or that kind of a thing. They really like seek out and want a lot of reassurance, especially in romantic relationships. And then the third one is an avoidant attachment style, which connects to the concept of being independent, right? So if a child develops an avoidant attachment style, it's because their parent was just not there. They just weren't there. It's not like the anxious attachment style where like sometimes the parent is there and wants to be really close, sometimes they're not, or the secure attachment style where the parent is consistently there. A child who develops an avoidant attachment style is just kind of like, I can't count on or trust anybody. They're just not here for me. So then they grow up to become a very independent adult, and not necessarily like the positive connotation of the word independence, they don't get close to anybody. They don't want to lean on anybody, even people who are healthy and safe people. They want to do things completely 100% themselves. Because they don't know what it is to have that emotional closeness or to be able to lean on people. So that's a lot of information that I hope is helpful about attachment styles and then codependence, independence, and interdependence. But like a big distinction that I see between codependence, which we're talking about today, and then the goal of like interdependence is that like when somebody errs more on the side of showing up codependently in relationships, like a lot of times, again, the focus in a codependent relationship is that you really want to make sure that the other person is okay. You're focused on their needs and wanting it to be that, again, like you're not rocking the boat or upsetting them in any way. So when you then maybe need to make a decision on your own, your first gut instinct might be rather than introspecting and being like, oh, well, what do I want? Oh, well, I want this, right? That might feel like a pretty scary, uncomfortable thing to do because it's like, well, maybe I could come up with something I want, but is that what they're going to want? I want to do what they want because that is safe to make sure that they are happy and that they are okay. So it could feel really uncomfortable to make decisions on your own, whereas somebody who's, you know, functioning more interdependently in their relationships is like, no, I feel I'm just going to say what I want. Maybe people like it. Maybe they don't. But I'm going to show up and kind of be me and this, you know, speak up for what feels good and right to me. They feel more comfortable doing that. And the other thing is, you know, somebody who moves through the world more codependently, you could say, they're very used to having someone in their lives to take care of. And somebody, when it comes to interdependence, you're going to want it to be that, like, we each take care of ourselves for the most part. And it's like you were saying, Kate, right? This isn't like, you know, we all fall on hard times. We all sometimes need to be like, hey, I need a helping hand here, right? But somebody who's more interdependent is going to be more attracted to people in their lives. And I don't mean like a romantic or sexual attraction, but just like a more broad attraction. They're going to be attracted more to people who like also are able to take care of themselves. Whereas somebody who's more codependent often has somebody who's like a project that they're taking care of. They are more attracted to the people who are struggling, who need, you know, need, quote unquote, who give off the impression that like, I want to be taken care of. Can you take care of me? Because somebody who's functioning more codependently, they feel really good about themselves when they have someone to take care of. More interdependent, you're going to be like, that gets old pretty quick. I'm just, you know, let's each focus on our own needs and that kind of a thing. But on that note, I mean, when you're functioning from a healthy place of interdependence, a big sign that you'll know that you're in an interdependent headspace rather than a codependent headspace is that in interdependency, you ask for what you need. And people around you ask for what they need. If everybody's functioning interdependently, that's what's going to happen. And you are able to get to this place where you know for yourself, hey, guess what? I don't need to be constantly trying to anticipate other people's needs. Basically, like, if they need help, they will let me know. And if they let me know that they need help, then I will, again, introspect and decide, do I feel comfortable providing the help that they're offering? But I'm going to trust that they know how to take care of themselves. And it's like you said too about like the dentist appointments, Kate. People don't always take good care of themselves, but it's also trusting like, okay, but it's their life and it's their consequences. And it's not my job to try to like prevent those consequences from happening for them and anticipating their needs. Like I trust them to be able to do things on their own and that they will let me know if they need some help. And again, you can offer it. I'll talk about this a little bit later on, but it's okay to say to somebody, hey, if you need help with that, let me know. Like, I'm happy to help you if you'd like it. But then you're done. You're done at that point. you have offered. It's in their hands to let you know if they want your help. You're not just jumping in and helping people all the time. And that's a big difference between codependency and this, you know, as the listener stated, like a more natural need to exist in relationships with other people, is this recognition that we don't have to move through the world anticipating other people's needs all the time. They can take care of their own needs, even if they don't always do it well or how we'd like. They can. And to give them a little bit of space to do that. So hopefully that makes sense. I talked a lot because I just loved this question so much. There was so much to say.
No, I thought it was great. It was funny. I don't know. I had to keep myself from interrupting when you were talking about the anxious attachment stuff and being like, stop talking about me, Michelle.
Yep. I know that's you.
That's me. So that's always a little like, I'm fanning myself like, oh dear. I know. It's just like, oh, well, damn it. Still working on it. Loading boundaries, loading bar. I've always wanted a t-shirt that has that, just says boundaries and has a partially filled loading bar on underneath.
Yeah, that's great.
That says loading dot, 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 because that's probably me forever. No, I thought it was great. Yes, you talked a lot, but it was good information. The next question is there a relationship between BPD, borderline personality disorder, and codependency?
Yes. There is. And the first thing that I thought about, which is like one of the key traits of BPD, is that somebody with a BPD diagnosis has pretty deep fears of abandonment. And I was thinking about how that feature of BPD can play into codependency. And what I was thinking about with that is that somebody struggling with codependency, like, often will find, whether they realize it consciously or not, that like a large part of their identity is wrapped up in either like wanting to save other people, or the other way that this can look is wanting to be the one who is saved by other people, wanting to be taken care of. We haven't talked about codependency so much in that form yet in the episode, because I think, again, kind of the ways that we're taught about codependency is, again, as like the person who overfunctions and stuff. But you can certainly find people who, right, they're codependent in the regard of they want to be the one taken care of. They don't want to take care of themselves. They don't want to do things for themselves on their own. They want somebody to do that for them. It can really go either way. But whichever way it goes, I mean, when it comes to a BPD diagnosis, a lot of times, either of those things, the either like, oh, I want to like save or rescue or fix or help other people, or I want other people to rescue, fix, help, save me, it comes from this place of like, if I'm not in one of those two things, they're gonna leave me. Like, I'm not gonna have anybody. Right? So if I'm not taking care of other people, they're going to leave me because I need to like prove my worth to them. Or again, I need it to be that I'm the one being taken care of and I fear so deeply that somebody's going to stop taking care of me. They're going to leave me.
Well, like, right? If I'm needy, then they'll want to stay, right? Like, if I'm needy enough, they'll feel like they need to take care of me and won't leave. Yeah.
Totally. Yep. 100%. So I really see those things sometimes. They can show up because you're so, so, so scared of abandonment and being left that you turn to either of those things to try to keep people close to you. And it can definitely play into, I think, codependency. There's this term, it's not part of a clinical diagnosis of BPD in any way. I don't know if I told you this, Kate. I had never heard the term favorite person until listeners started writing in with it.
Oh, really?
I truly had it.
Oh.
Yeah, no. I was like, when, you know, but many of our listeners write in and talk about favorite people, and I was like, huh. Never thought of it that way, but true. Yep. So thank you, listeners. But people will talk who have a BPD diagnosis, they'll talk about having an FP or a favorite person. And so, again, I think sometimes within the context of codependency, there can be this very, like, quick attachment process that happens. Like, we are all in. I'm very close to people right away. And that is not so unlike what can happen with a favorite person for somebody diagnosed with BPD. And so it's also there's also potentially a relationship there, I think, between codependency and then, like, finding a favorite person right away. That favorite person relationship, hate to say it, it's probably got some codependency going on within it. For why that attachment probably feels as strong as it does. And again, there could just be like a deep, deep fear of abandonment that can come, especially within a favorite person relationship. So those are some connections that I see there.
Yeah, I see a couple others from a couple of different directions. Your mind, Michelle, went right to the, pardon me, the fears of abandonment. My brain went immediately to the unstable sense of self. Again, these are the wordings from the diagnostic criteria. A lot of what can happen for folks with BPD, with this sort of unstable sense of self, is they can end up deriving a lot of their identities from their relationships anyway, right? One of the things folks will notice sometimes who maybe has a friend who has BPD or a family member is that as they get in a different relationship, it's like they're a whole new human. To be the human they quote unquote should be for that relationship or for that partner. Right? So I would say that that makes them essentially more vulnerable to codependent tendencies or behavior, right? When you're in this place where you're taking so much of who you know yourself to be from your partnership, it's pretty easy to get into a lot of overfunctioning behaviors to hold on to it, right? Which is very similar, Michelle, to what you're talking about, right? Like, they're sort of not even different enough to be two sides of the same coin. Different years of the same coin? I don't know, right? An anniversary edition? Right? Where it's, again, this, it's, you just, you're like, well, I don't know who I am without this human, so I need to do what I need to do to hold on to this human. So that's one way that I think about it being related to, or what's it, a relationship between BPD and codependency. The other one, not meaning to ruffle anybody's feathers, we definitely want to acknowledge that, well, A, not everyone with BPD has any given symptom of BPD. And also, like any other mental health issue, it exists on a continuum, on a spectrum or a range of severity. But for some folks on there, some of their more, I guess you could say more mood-dependent behaviors, right? Some of the more intense symptoms that can come from BPD for folks who are really suffering, really going through it. Those behaviors can end up with folks who have BPD as the, I had a hard time thinking of how to phrase this, but like the target of codependent behaviors, as in the person being placated or being overfunctioned for, or being kind of like what you were already saying, Michelle, right? Like, you could, there's the other side of the coin is sometimes wanting to be the person being taken care of. Or, you know, wanting to be in need, right, to help cement that relationship. And so, right, like, that can be something that does elicit that kind of behavior from people in relationship. So I think it can go both ways, where they might be more likely to exhibit that side of codependent behavior as well as the more, quote unquote, traditional side of it.
Next question says, which DBT skills can address codependence?
Well, I will say Michelle's going to get to some really good ones. She got to the notes first. But no one will be surprised. If you've listened to more than two episodes of this entire show, I suspect that no one is surprised that self-soothing with the five senses is my first one. This is a first one in part because, you know, sort of already outed that I struggle a bit with codependent behavior. It's one of the skills I use for that. Because I get some real big feelings that can come up when I'm resisting rescuing or resisting managing someone. And especially even larger feelings can come up if someone reacts negatively to you no longer engaging in your codependent behaviors. Right? That can elicit some pretty intense feels. that you can't necessarily do anything about the situation involved. So how do you take care of yourself, right? How do you show yourself kindness to help get through that really tough spot? And so I think self-soothing can be a really nice skill to be deployed in those times. I like pros and cons here a lot, actually, for engaging in codependent urges, right? Whatever the codependent behavior is going to vary depending on the type of relationship and independent, you know, each individual relationship is going to be unique in this fashion. But you know, right, if you're someone who struggles with codependent behaviors or urges, you know what your behaviors and urges are. So doing pros and cons for those so you can really have something to reflect back on, to look at, to arm yourself with for helping yourself hold boundaries or perhaps not engage in that behavior moving forward. And the last one I thought about was a check the facts to ground folks, ground yourself in what did I say? What is whose responsibility, right? So trying to remind yourself of, what's yours? What's someone else's? What the catastrophe is or more likely isn't if you don't engage in that behavior. I thought check the facts could be a well-utilized skill as well. I probably could have come up with, I mean, you and me, the more we talk about fucking DBT skills, Michelle, the more I feel like we're capable of finding a way that a skill could be applied to almost anything. You're like, man, I could, if you give me long enough, I'll find a way for almost any skill to end up being helpful if I wait long enough and work my way around it, because we've just thought about the damn thing so much.
I think that's true.
So, those are my first three, and I could go on, but I'm trying not to go on too much. So, what do you think about, Michelle, when it comes to skills for this?
Yeah, I came up with two skills. The first one, oh gosh, radical acceptance. Just, it's huge. It's huge when it comes to codependency. Like, I truly cannot emphasize it enough of how important it is to practice radical acceptance, because it is hard. It's hard to accept other people's choices when we don't like them, rather than try to change the other person and the choices that they're making, which we can do in all kinds of either obvious or subtle ways, trying to get someone to change or trying to deny it to ourselves, of like the actual truth of what's going on. So just radical acceptance as much as you can, over and over, every day. That's about all I'll say there. But the second one I thought about was fast. Because, I mean, fast is all about self-respect. Self-respect. So rather than, again, like focusing on the other person's experience, what they want, what they need, what would make them happy, which is so much of the focus when it comes to codependency, is other people. Fast is about focusing on yourself in a lot of ways. So I'm just going to really, really briefly recap here. But right, the F is for fair. So thinking about what's fair to you and to the other person. Thinking about what's fair to yourself often gets overlooked with codependency. The A stands for no apologies. I think the more somebody struggles with codependency, the more likely they are to needlessly apologize for things that are not actually their fault. And again, that's often done in an effort to try to just like keep the other person happy and smooth things over and not have them be upset with you and that kind of a thing. So practicing not apologizing, really important. The S is sticking to values. So knowing what your own values are and what's important to you and feeling comfortable naming what matters to you. Even if the other person may not like or agree with your values, sticking to them anyways. And then the T is being truthful. So making sure that you are being honest and upfront about what's on your mind? What's bothering you? And when it comes to fast, I mean, Kate and I say this all the time, right? Like, this is the skill that we recommend following when it comes to saying no to people. You can say no in a way that is fair without apologizing because you're sticking to your values and being truthful. And in general, saying no is really hard for people who struggle with codependency because you don't want people to be upset with you. And so you may worry, well, if I tell this person, no, I can't help them, or whatever it is, no, I don't like that, they're going to get upset with me, and that's my worst fear. So I'm not going to say no. I'm going to go along and say yes and just make do, and it's fine, and blah, 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 whatever justification you may use in your head. So fast is a good one to practice, and it will take a lot of practice the more you struggle with codependency. That's what I would recommend, radical acceptance and fast.
I like them. So outside of DBT, what other therapy skills might you use to supplement DBT to work on addressing codependency?
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of just, for me, I wanted to pick and choose the highlights from my own past, 6 years in therapy. 6 years and counting. 7 years. 7 years and counting. I don't know. It's been a long time that I've been working with my therapist. She's amazing. And I keep going to her because codependency is something I still struggle with all the time. But a big thing that I learned, and I referenced this a little bit earlier, because again, I was taught and I was told, and I still see my mom do this to this day, right? She anticipates other people's needs and she just dives in and helps all the time, right? And she paints it as like, this is me being a good person, right? And to actually learn that that's not actually healthy or okay to do. And that what you can do instead is to say to people, hey, I'm here if you need me, right? If you'd like some help with that, let me know and I'm happy to help. And then guess what? You're done. You step back. And if they decide they want your help, they can tell you. And if they say, hey, actually, can you help me with that after all? Then you could be like, yeah, absolutely. And you can help them. But if they don't ask for help, you don't lift a finger. So that was a hard thing for me to learn. And it's a very tough thing for me when I see my mom doing this with me and other people in her life where she's like, ah, oh, this is a problem. Let me just fix it for you. And I'm like, I didn't necessarily view it as a problem. And I didn't need your help, but cool. Thanks. The other thing that I think really stands out is like, we talk about this word selfish, right? And what does that mean? And selfish has its negative connotations to it and stuff like that. But like, I've really had to learn over the years that like, it is okay to take care of myself first. Because a lot of times what would happen for me, because my ex struggled with alcoholism, my husband struggles with depression and PTSD and anxiety. And I have thought for so long that like, if for some reason they were, I don't know, having a hard time, right? If my ex was hungover after a night of drinking, if my husband's really depressed and he doesn't want to leave the house, that somehow like I was going to be like a bad partner if I was doing things that I wanted to do. Like I really did. I kind of had this idea in my head of like, if they're down, I need to like join them there and try to help them get out of that state. Right. And that I'm bad or I'm wrong if like, I don't know, say my ex is hungover and I was like, well, I want to go do this. So bye. That like that was somehow wrong to do what I wanted to do if it was something that like they just weren't up to or that they didn't want to do. But it's taken me a while in therapy to learned that like, no, ultimately what you want is to have a relationship where like both people in the relationship know what it means to keep themselves individually healthy and okay. They both have things that they do to take care of their mental health, their physical health, their social life, their passions, their hobbies. Ideally, both people in a relationship bring that to the table. And then it's figuring out how do we keep some things for each of us to like do on our own? And like, where do we merge and where do we mesh? But if you have a partner that's not bringing much to the table for themselves and like how they take care of themselves or get like what their interests are, they may not have much in that regard. Then at least for me, I've at times felt guilty or like bad about having like this full life myself. Like that's somehow, you know, not okay. 'Cause I'm supposed to help them, right? Help them lead a more full life. Well, no, that's not my job. It's not my job at all. That's their job. So what I would say with that is like, don't be afraid to bring what you want to the table when it comes to like making decisions or again, like doing things that you want to do, even though you know that it may be different than what your partner wants or what they're capable of or whatever the situation may be. Like, bring it anyways. Say what you want. Do things that feel good to you and recognize that like that's the only way that you have any shot at being a good partner. Is to just like be a happy human on your own. And then that's gonna impact how you show up in the relationship with your partner, hopefully positively.
Yeah, that is all good thought. That is all good thoughts. Yeah. Woof. We're speaking English very well today. I like your thoughts, Michelle, I suppose is what I was trying to say there. So let's see, some other things to think about. One is, I would say, mindfulness. I know mindfulness is a DBT skill, bear me out. I think that so much of the mindfulness, like as a skill as we talk about in DBT, is so much about being in the moment, right? Right here, right now, non-judgmentally, right? Aware of the moment. And I'm talking about mindfulness more in the colloquial term, which is paying attention to shit. And so if we are people who are prone to doing a check of, is this moment tolerable? Yes, no. That's not enough of a question. You gotta practice looking at if things are situational or if they're consistent, right? If they're chronic over the course of a relationship, right? We've talked about this, I want to say, 2 or 3 times over the course of the episode so far in different ways or places, but, right, it's okay for there to be, you know, out of whack moments and times and periods in people's relationships. I'll just own it. Let's see. I'm about to have a relatively major surgery. I am not going to be contributing 50% for a few weeks. Like, no, I am not going to be doing my equal share. And that's fine. It's okay that things are out of whack for a few weeks because it, you know, if my husband were to look at it and be like, wow, does Kate chronically do way less than her amount of stuff in the relationship? The answer is no. Right? You know, so if you look at this moment, it looks terrible, but also, you know, you can see that it's larger. But sometimes the moment you're like, well, it's not great right now, but it's okay. I can tolerate it. And you just stay there in that technically tolerable place for really long spans of years. I know, like, long spans of time, right? So you need to look bigger. You need to zoom out sometimes, right? You can't just be mindfulness like they talk about it in DBT, important though that skill is. It's also important to be able to zoom out and take a more of a long, longitudinal, that's the word I want, longitudinal look at a relationship and see if this is a theme as opposed to an isolated incident that you can tolerate because of course it's tolerable. It's not chronic. Right? And one of the reasons to do this is because when you're chronically giving more and more than the other person, when you're overfunctioning, when you're doing all the lovely stuff that we've been talking about for the last hour-ish, you're gonna be deep down breeding some resentment in there. You may not notice it right away, but I can pretty much promise you it's there. It's natural for it to be there, honestly, right? I mean, grant you, you're you know, participating in the situation, but it is a resentment-building situation to consistently overfunction for another human being. Right? It just is. Now, the secret here is that even having a lot of anger, which I think both Michelle and I could probably cop to, codependent folks can harbor a lot of anger and resentment.
You don't want to show it or
no, good Lord, no. No, I don't want to know I'm feeling it. I don't want to share that I'm feeling it, like, openly. I don't want people to be able to, like, look at me and know that I'm feeling it. And yeah, it's just, like, eats away at you, figuratively and literally, right? This can be everything from just, it is eroding the very relationship you're behaving that way to try and save. Because resentment, let me tell you, not good for a relationship. But also as, like, health issues or addiction behaviors for yourself or, you know, other escapism kind of things. So, that's where more of the mindfulness, as DBT sells it, comes back in, which is you got to be aware of yourself, right? Like, you got to notice the anger. Step one, right, is see that it's there. Fantastic if you can go past that into starting to, like, share about it, right, with whoever is the object of your ire. But bare minimum, start giving it some acknowledgement. Right? See it. Validate it. Right? Like, let yourself have the emotion as a place to start. But also, I would say, like, as you can, and I have a lot of compassion for struggling with this, lots of empathy for struggling with this, but as you can, in the places perhaps where you notice that you're, you know, oh, I have a little codependency here, but not a, you know, heaping fucking dumpster fire truck full of it. Right, like we talk about with most skills, it's better to practice in slightly easier contexts first. But, you know, try and practice taking the risk of telling other people, like Michelle was talking about, telling other people what you want. Like I'm talking about telling other people what's bothering you, where your anger is, where your resentment is. And maybe seeing how it feels to not step up and overfunction. Try taking out those risks in small places, right? Seeing if you can feel your way through it. See if you can notice that along with whatever anxiety or other emotions might be cropping up with it, can you also notice some pride or some relief, right? Some gratitude, something to hold on to that can help pull you through the difficulty of it. So mindfulness. There you go. Personal bravery. I don't know, is that a skill? Right?
I think so.
Yeah, so those...
hard to be brave.
Yup.
Not easy at all.
Yup. So there you go. I think those are the... the skills? Practices? I don't know. Areas of focus? That I would recommend.
Awesome. Well, that brings us to the end of the questions. So we're gonna wrap up the episode here with a couple things. So... what you guys have become accustomed to over the last few months now, 5 months? I don't know how many coffee hours we've done now, but normally at the end of each of our monthly episodes, we're plugging the coffee hour for the following month and letting you know what the topic is going to be that we're going to be talking about. But Kate and I made the decision, as Kate mentioned briefly, she will be having a pretty major surgery coming up soon. Fingers crossed, my husband and I are planning to move soon. Not a huge, tremendous, ginormous move. We plan to stay in the same county. But basically, Kate and I were realizing the first week of October is likely going to be a very busy, hectic, chaotic time for us. So we will not be doing a coffee hour in October, and we also decided to skip the months of November and December as well because holidays are coming. So basically, we will not be having any coffee hours for the rest of the year. Yeah, we'll be yeah, TBD coming back in the new year and figuring out some new topics then. If you are a mental health professional and you're curious to know, like, what are the topics that we've already done, and you can definitely purchase past recordings, just send us an email about that and we can get you sorted there. And the other thing I was realizing as far as some, like, I don't know, potential resources as we close talking about this topic of codependency. And if you're like, hey, I just learned a lot about what this is and crap, I struggle with this. There are a couple of our podcast episodes from The Couch and the Chair that might be helpful to listen to. So one, the title of it is When Your Partner Struggles with Substance Abuse. It may look different than you think. We posted that episode April 30th of 2021. So you can go back and find that. But basically a lot of that episode, I very briefly mentioned it today. I didn't go into a lot of personal sharing, but I was in a relationship with someone for 8 years who struggled with addiction and alcoholism. So I really go in depth about my experiences on that episode. And then Kate and I both share on another episode about people pleasing. It's titled People Pleasing, Unlearning Old Patterns. And we posted that one September 3rd, 2021. So you can, again, just hear more personal sharing from us about how all of this has shown up over the course of our lives. So that may be helpful. And then I was thinking, too, there are meetings, like 12-step meetings, Codependence Anonymous, CODA meetings, if you're wanting more support and help with changing codependency in your life. I would encourage you to find a local CODA meeting. So you could just search for Codependence Anonymous, just Google it, and find the website there. Or again, if you are in a relationship with somebody who's struggling with addiction, Al-Anon meetings could also be a potential good resource for you to consider when it comes to this topic. So a couple resources there. But we thought we'd go back to what we were doing before we started coffee hours, which was sharing our takeaways from the episode before we wrap up too today. So Kate, what are you taking away from today with everything we talked about?
Well, a couple of different things. Humorously, my thought was, I am codependent as fuck. I mean, I kind of already knew that, but Jesus fucking face. It's true. But more, I don't know. It's one of the things that I think stood out to me the most was while Michelle, I had, of course, I don't know, I was independently aware of and even talked about it many times in my course of life as a professional. The idea of like independent, interdependent, and codependent, right? Those sort of spectrums or the attachment styles, I don't think I'd ever mapped those on top of each other in that way. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. So I think just a new sort of, honestly, just a little bit of a professional. Oh, I just never twisted my head right to look at those two things together in that way.
I think for me, actually, one of the things that I really liked and needed a reminder of, which is what you were sharing there actually at the end about how you're like, this is mindfulness, but not like the typical DBT mindfulness. Because, I mean, one of the things that I really struggle with myself, right, we can also conceptualize wise mind as the intersection of doing and being mind. Mm-hmm. And I've shared before, I am really perpetually in my doing mind, like all the time. And so just getting that reminder from you of like, really, it's being able to tune in and notice, okay, like, what is actually happening here? Because sometimes I don't always take that step back. Like, that's why, like, what I shared on last month's episode that, you know, kind of inspired this listener to write in and be like, hey, talk more about this, was so like powerful, is because that's been going on in my relationship for years. And I just wasn't like noticing. I wasn't paying attention to like look internally at my own experience and pay attention to like what's going on the inside of me. I mean, that's the thing too about like the anger. God, if you were to ask me like a couple years ago, I would be like, I don't ever feel angry. No, I feel angry all the time. All the time. But I deny it. I suppress it. I don't feel comfortable with it. I stuff it away. All the time. Like, and so I think just kind of that reminder of like, oh, it's not just enough for me to have like a good working knowledge of like, what is codependency? Because I have a pretty decent, like, you know, brain knowledge of what it is. But it's like, oh, I need to remember and really pay attention to noticing how I feel internally in my relationships with other people. How do I feel with other people? And I want to work on not shying away when that internal alarm bell goes off of like, oh, that feels uncomfortable. I don't really want to do that, but I'm saying yes anyways, right? Like, we know that feeling, that internal gut feeling when kind of like, well, I'm saying yes, though I really want to say no. Codependency alert. Right? Like, I want to do a better job of paying attention to that for myself. So I think this episode was just a very good reminder, especially what you were saying at the end there about like, notice, tune in. That's where you have to start. Mm-hmm. So that was helpful.
Sorry, I don't mean to laugh. I think it was the way you flashed your hands when you said codependency alert that my brain went to like the bat signal or something, right? Like, codependency! Like, no! Anyway.
Yeah, that's a key thing also, you guys. If you're like, well, how do I know when I be codependent? There's a key clue right there. When you're saying yes and you know you want to say no.
Yep, good thing to right check there. Out. Yep. Word. all right, guys, I hope there's not too much traffic noise in the closing moment. Ugh. Because I think we're ready for it, and I don't think Auburn traffic is at all ready for it. So.
Probably not, but that's okay.
Okay. All right. Let's start by just getting comfortable, whatever that means for you today. It can be standing, sitting down, laying down, walking. What feels good and right to your body right now? And if you're safe and you feel comfortable doing so, I invite you to go ahead and close your eyes. As per usual, I'm going to start by just noticing our breath. You don't need to breathe any more slowly or any more deeply than you are naturally. It's just about paying attention. Just about tuning in to the rhythms and the sensations of your breath and letting them welcome you into your body and into the present moment. Now, one of the things that you'll notice that Michelle and I talked about a lot tonight was a difficulty in feeling grounded in yourself, your own wants, your own needs, your own desires and expectations. Even a sense of self at times can be difficult when you're struggling with codependency. One of the things that can help us to ground ourselves to ourselves is our values. Being able to remember them, being able to bring up tangible evidence of them and memories of the way we've behaved that are in alignment with them. So for today's closing moment, I invite you to take just a couple minutes here and try and think, what are my top three values? This isn't a pop quiz. Your answers don't have to be permanent or even quote unquote right. This is just a good exercise. You can always repeat it later. So just think right now as you ponder, what stand out to you as the three values that are most core to you, most central to how you move through the world, to how you judge yourself or the actions of others in the world, right? You get things like charity or community, productivity, curiosity. Right. What is important to you?
What guides your choices? Where's the ground that you stand on when you know yourself best? As you are able to list or think about your top three values, see if you can't find a memory, one memory for each value. Some moment in your life where you were living really grounded in that value, you were acting out of that value. Regardless of who else was or wasn't around for it, this isn't about them. This is about you, who you are, and how you know yourself. So just take a moment, or three, and see if you can't think of at least one concrete example of a time you lived from each of these three values. Whether that be something you've done in the last week or something you did years ago. And remember these. As they come to you, try and really cement them. Remind yourself that this is a thing you can come back to. When you're feeling adrift, when you feel like you don't know yourself, like you can't see yourself, like you're unsure of where you stand or who you are or where you're going, remember that you have guiding lights, that your values are there for you, and that you have experience of what it feels like to live from those values. If you've struggled to come up with the values or the memories in the time that I've been talking, that's okay. You can keep going after I stop or come back to it later or make a longer list if you want to than just your top three. But for now, if you feel ready, you can go ahead and start coming back into your body and back into the room. You might do some gentle stretches, rotating your wrists or ankles, neck or shoulders. And whenever you feel ready, you can open your eyes. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thanks, everybody. To learn more about us and the DBT skills we're teaching each week, join our Facebook group. Simply log in to your Facebook profile and search for DBT and Me podcast.